Good morning. So I think we are up here to all be here and ready to begin the third oral argument on our calendar today. This is the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and today's date is June 17th, 2020. I will make just a couple of quick remarks and then turn it over to counsel. So first of all, I'll remind you and everyone to mute your microphone during the time that you are not speaking. It improves the sound quality for us and just reduces some of the background noise. Second thing is, before you begin your remarks, if you would identify yourself for the record, as well as your client's name, and then keep an eye on the time. The marshal will show you how he's going to indicate the time. There will be a clock visible to you. If for some reason you lose a visual on the clock, please let us know and we'll make sure that we get that sorted out so that you know what's happening. So before we begin the argument, I'm going to ask the marshal to call the case and then I will turn it over to appellant's counsel.
All right. Now calling file number 820-0242. Regarding the estate of Adolph J. Wagner, deceased, and in the matter of the revocable trust agreement of Adolph J. Wagner.
All right, with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Jonathan D. Wolf. I am here on behalf of the appellant, Deborah Farm. The facts of this case are really pretty straightforward. The decedent and Janet Wagner were married for over 20 years. They both brought children into this marriage. Decedent's two adult children are the respondents in the present matter. Janet Wagner brought three children into this marriage, one of whom is my client, the appellant, and the other two of whom have interests aligned with my client and have supported us in this matter, with the exception of Daniel Dale, who passed away during the pendency of this matter, so unfortunately can no longer support his similarly aligned siblings. So in 1994, decedent Janet Wagner executed four very important documents. These were a will for each of them, an agreement to execute those wills in the form agreed to, and a revocable trust agreement. These documents were executed as a package. They all built upon and incorporated one another. So the agreement to execute wills says, we agreed to execute these specific wills, and the wills were explicitly made a part of that agreement. The wills in turn say the trust as it then existed were made a part of the wills. So all the documents are by reference fully incorporated into the contract, the agreement to execute wills as they then existed in 1994. Naturally, the thrust of all these documents is to provide for all of the children of this combined family, the children of both parties, regardless of who died first. And that's just what the documents do for 20 years. No attempts to breach the agreement or to do anything with these documents until 2014. In 2014, in what I think is pretty much the definition of suspicious timing, the decedent purports to unilaterally revoke the 1994 trust as Janet Wagner lay dying. And he doesn't tell her this. He doesn't get her consent. He doesn't purport to do anything with the 1994 agreement or the wills. He just signs a document that says, I revoke the trust itself. That's all he does. Now, the parties below stipulated to the fact that Janet Wagner did not consent to this. That is a fact that I think the district court got wrong. 10 days later, after this purported revocation, Janet Wagner is dead. And over the next several months, the decedent executes a new suite of his own estate planning documents, the effect of which seemed to be to disinherit Janet Wagner's children to favor his own. In so doing, he completely ignores the agreement the parties made in 1994. Now, there's no disagreement at all as to these facts. The parties, in fact, stipulated the relevant facts below in lieu of a trial and submitted the matter to the district court on the written submissions and the arguments of counsel. So the overall question in this appeal is whether the district court erred in finding really there was nothing at all wrong with what decedent did. The standard of review here.
So, counsel, I'd like to just be a little bit more specific about the issue. Now, you did file petitions in this case, right? And as I understand it, your petitions challenged the will of our decedent, Adolf. I'll refer to him as Adolf Wagner, and then challenged his 2014 trust as well. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
As I understand it, you're arguing that the 1994 contract means that today what is effective are the 1994 will of Adolf and the 1994 trust. Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor. When somebody breaches a contract to will or a contract to devise, the typical remedy is specific performance. You hold them what they agreed to. What they agreed to was the 1994 wills. So we believe that is the proper remedy here. And that's what we're asking
for. So here's my trouble with your argument, counsel, and it's pretty similar to what you heard from the district court. As you noted, the 1994 agreement, this contract to will, does incorporate the 1994 wills, which also incorporate the 1994 trust. And the 1994 trust is expressly, as you already mentioned, revocable by either party without the other party's consent. So isn't that what Adolf did? Wasn't that contemplated really in the 1994 agreement?
Your Honor, if either party can, in fact, unilaterally revoke the trust without consequence, then the agreement is illusory.
And counsel, that is the argument you made in your brief. And I just want to stop you because I definitely understand your argument. Your illusory contract argument is one I certainly grasp the meaning of. But I want to start with, what does the plain language of the 1994 trust say? It gives a unilateral right to revoke, doesn't it?
It does include that language, but I'll direct you, Your Honor, to the Concordia College case that is also cited in the brief. That trust in that case had the exact same language, or very similar language at least, and it said in that trust, as it does in this one, except as otherwise specified. It was otherwise specified in this case, just like it was in Concordia College.
Well, that's where I struggle as well, counsel, because yes, there is something else in the 1994 trust. It says that the family share will not be revocable after one of the settlers dies. So that's the otherwise specified in this particular trust. So, I certainly saw all of these arguments in the briefs. I just didn't see your response. So it is otherwise specified. So what is the court to do?
Well, I think it's otherwise specified in the other documents as well, because the trust as it then existed in 1994 is incorporated into the wills, and nobody did anything with the wills. And under both wills, Janet Wagner's and decedent's, when the first one of them died, if the trust was not then in existence in its 1994 form, we were supposed to treat the circumstances as though it was and distribute the property according to the trust, which, as you noted, included making the family share irrevocable at that point in time. So I think you have to look at these documents as a whole rather than really focusing narrowly into some of this boilerplate reservation of right language in the trust. That language is in the trust. It's in most trusts, but there is case law saying that just basically the fact that it says it's a revocable trust on the document doesn't mean the contract to devise is invalid. And I'll also note there was a practical reason for keeping it revocable and keeping that language in there. If both the parties got together and agreed, hey, let's change our trust, they wanted to be able to do that. What they didn't want to have happen is what did happen. One of them goes out on their own without the consent of the other and changes things entirely. So I think that's the reason for the reservation of the right to change things if they both got together and consented to it.
So what language in this suite of four documents do you rely on for this court to say that what the parties could have done was agreed to mutually revoke the 1994 trust? Because I don't see any, and I need your help on that.
Well, I don't know that language is in the documents. I think that's case law, and I think that's Minnesota law. The parties made a contract here. There's offer acceptance, there's consideration. In any contract, one party can't unilaterally back out of it without the consent of the other. Now, I think there are options. Both parties say we are no longer bound by this contract. I think they can do that under Minnesota law.
So maybe we're miscommunicating a bit, counsel. So I am not suggesting, as I understood your argument about inability to revoke unilaterally to primarily relate to the 1994 agreement, this contract to will, given the express language in the trust is that it is revocable. That's what I'm looking for is some clue in the 1994 agreement that mutual consent would be required to revoke.
Your Honor, So the 1994 agreement to make wills is a contract. It's a contract on its face. There's offer, there's acceptance, there's consideration. In these cases that talk about self-designating as irrevocable, those cases only deal with when the only written evidence of the contract is the wills themselves. Under the relevant statute here, if all you have is the wills, they do have to say that you're irrevocable, but that's not what this is. This was a contract to execute these wills in a certain way. That's what the parties did. Now, you can always revoke the wills. Adolf could have revoked his will, but by doing so, he would have breached that contract. The same applies to the trust. And if you look at the case law, this is backed up. You can revoke a will, you can revoke a revocable trust, but you might be breaching your contractual obligations by doing so. And that's what we allege happened here, at least with our first argument.
Okay, so give me your line of reasoning on that. So why is it that Adolf cannot revoke his will, even though, as you said, his will is presumably revocable?
Sure.
So, and again, rely on the language of the 1994 agreement, because that's where I don't see your argument.
The parties said in that agreement, we agree not to renounce one another's wills. That's explicit language.
Right. What does it mean, counsel, to renounce a will legally? Isn't that a term of art?
It means to disavow the terms of the will. And I think that's exactly what he did.
Right. Disavow the terms of a will. In exchange for what?
In exchange for the other party's will. What the parties exchanged here were making their wills in a fashion that was satisfactory to both. Go ahead, Your Honor. I see you're shaking.
Counsel, let me just back you up for a second, because what the promise they made to each other is they would not renounce the other's will, right? Adolf would not renounce Janet's will. So how does that work? Because when I read our case law, it's different from what you're arguing.
When he agreed not to renounce her will that stood at the time of her death said if the trust is gone at the time of her death, it re-arises. He didn't do anything with trying to revoke her will, nor could he revoke someone else's will. And by pretending as though the trust was not later in existence, he's renouncing that provision of her will that says, we treat this trust as if it exists, even if it had been revoked. This was a belt and suspenders approach in this case. The parties, it seems, or at least their attorneys, contemplated what would happen if somebody tried to revoke the trust. And it was that at the time of the first of their deaths, it would re-arise as it then existed. That's explicit language in both wills. But Janet Wagner's is the operative will because she was the one who died first.
So, counsel, I am struggling with your analysis at the of Janet's will as saying that the 1994 trust re-arises. So perhaps you'd like to point again to the language in Janet's will that says the trust re-arises. I see where it says and acknowledges that the 1994 trust, that's in 3.2, would not be in existence at her death. So implicitly, she's acknowledging that the 1994 trust could be revoked. What I see her fallback is in her will, which apparently is still valid today, is that the distributions would be in accordance with the method laid out in the 1994 trust. So the distributions from her will is what I see. So it would relate to any of her estate as it is distributed under her will. So I help me out if there's something more in there that I am missing.
Well, it says, in accordance with the provisions of the revocable trust agreement of Adolf J. Wagner and Janet D. Wagner, as if said trust agreement were set forth in full in this writing, and I hereby incorporate said trust instrument, comma, as it now exists, comma, in this will by reference. So in that will, in that trust agreement, the family share contained a portion, you know, as in most trust agreements, the idea is we preserve enough of the estate to provide for the living spouse until that person passes away. But we also preserve, you know, an amount for the family share after the first party passes away. The original intent of the party's agreement was to provide for the parties of both children after they've both been gone. So I think by incorporating the exact terms of that trust agreement as it then existed, the will and both wills, they both had an identical provision, were intending for the family share to become irrevocable at the time of death. And the trust provided that a portion of the assets were to be poured over into that family share and remain there, essentially.
So then what do we make of the fact this is called a revocable trust and, you know, Article 1 specifically permits amendment or revocation by either of the settlors? We just ignore that?
No, Your Honor, I don't think we ignore that. I think we recognize that they had a pre-existing agreement, and by unilaterally amending it, they breached that agreement. I think the Concordia College case is instructive on that point, because a very similar argument was made there. I'm running out of time here, so I think I'll just sum up by saying briefly, you know, the question here is really about, can you back out of a valid contract without consequence? And I think we have to ask ourselves, is what the parties did in 1994 meaningful or meaningless? And then what was their intent in doing that? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So counsel for respondent, we're ready for you to begin. Whoops. No, I'm not. There we go. We're ready for you to begin. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Michael Dolan. I represent the objectors below, who are the respondents here. They are the trustees of Adolph Wagner's 2014 trust as amended. The respondents here, objectors below, oppose the appellant's attempt to submit the 1994 will and the accompanying trust to probate as a result of Mr. Wagner properly revoking that trust, which he did in January of 2014, and executed a new will and a new trust in 2014, some 4 years before his divorce. Just from, I think, a correction of the factual circumstances, excuse me, the appellant's argument below was an attempt to submit the 1994 will of Adolph Wagner to probate. And as a result of that, submitting the 1994 trust to probate. We objected to that because of the existence of the 2014 documents. Adolph's 2014 estate plan would not need to be submitted to probate because there are no probate assets in it. And so essentially, the action involves the enforcement of the 1994 documents against the 2014 trust, essentially, is what the action is. And so, as you know, the trial court found, and we think properly found, that the documents from 1994 were not properly submitted to probate. And we think the trial court properly determined that Adolph Wagner's act of revoking the 1994 trust was not a violation, not a breach of a contract that he would have had between his spouse, Janet. We do not dispute that there was a contract in 1994. That's not the nature of our argument here. Our argument simply is that that agreement reached in 1994, by its very nature, was not irrevocable, and by the specific terms of the trust, which are incorporated into all of the documents and must be examined, I think, as the appellant describes, as a suite of documents, and we agree with that concept. Viewing those as a whole, not only do you get to revoke a plan, we believe, unless it says it's irrevocable, the specific provisions of this contract and this trust allow revocation, specifically as some of you have pointed out in Article 1.1 of the trust at the addendum, page 20. And so we believe that the trial court properly determined that Adolph Wagner had the authority to revoke an agreement and that he properly did revoke the agreement.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you about the ongoing validity of the 1994 agreement to make a will. I am not sure I follow your analysis on that in the brief. So is that a valid contract today, and is it enforceable?
I believe that it is not. It was a valid agreement when entered in 1994, but the terms of the agreement were not that that agreement would in its nature be irrevocable. All, it's our position, Your Honor, and I think the holding of the trial court, that all contracts to devise between parties are not by their very nature irrevocable. And that in the context of this case, there is no specific language within any of the suite of documents executed in 1994 that would indicate that the agreement itself is irrevocable. As support of that, I think we have the statute 2514, which defines, it's basically a statute of frauds for contracts to devise. And part of what it does is suggest that there are certain conditions that need to be met in order to enforce a contract to devise property, but also includes specific language about not to revoke. And so when we read this, that statute, it seems to clearly imply that not there are two parts to enforcing an old agreement of the parties to form an estate plan or devise property. First, to prove that you had that contract, and second, to prove that there is no authority to revoke that contract. And I think that
so, counsel, let's just assume for the moment that the 1994 agreement is revocable. So when did that happen? Because as I understood it, Adolf revoked the 1994 trust. He didn't revoke the 1994 agreement. And the only part of the suite of documents that even talks about revocability is the 1994 trust.
Right. And so if I understand your question, Your Honor, it is assume for a moment that the documents are revocable. Did he in fact act to revoke the will?
No, I'm asking whether he revoked the 1994 agreement to enter into this estate plan as a whole. Because as appellant pointed out, the 1994 agreement adopts the 1994 wills as they existed at the time, or at least he's got an argument to that effect.
Certainly. And so what the 1994 wills do is say distribute our property in a specific manner consistent with the trust that exists, even if we didn't end up funding the trust or following through on it. That's what the wills say. And so when Adolf Wagner would have revoked his consent to the 1994 trust and still was alive, he would have had the opportunity at that point to distribute the property in the manner that he wished because he had the right to revoke any portion of the agreement. It's not irrevocable in its nature. And so as soon as he revoked the trust, he continued to have authority at any point in time to exercise other acts of revocation.
What do we then make of the revival section of the will? The wills, the reciprocal wills, 3.2.
Yes. Well, I think the revival provisions, first of all, deal with the individual parties' assets that would exist at the time that they died and they had probate assets. And so essentially what Janet's will says is if the trust didn't come into effect or we didn't fund it, then you should distribute my property in a manner consistent with the terms of the trust as it existed at the time that I drafted this will. And so if we are talking about how Janet's probate assets back at the time of her death in 2014 could have been distributed, that's an interesting argument as it relates to her will. But at the time that Adolf Wagner died, since he had the authority to revoke any portion of the 1994 agreement, not just the trust, he was free to change his will even after Janet's death, because the trust no longer existed. And at that point in time, would not have been obliged to follow the reincarnation or resurrection section of his will. He would have a new will that didn't have those provisions. Is that responsive to your question, Your Honor? And so, Judge, I think in response to your question, I think what we're saying is that at any point in time, Mr. Wagner could have revoked any portion of his agreement, save and except that portion of the trust that says this portion of the trust can no longer be changed unless you have acted before one of the parties' death. So Adolf acted before that death and continued to have the absolute right to revoke any other portion of the estate plan because the documents do not indicate that the party's terms are irrevocable.
So if I'm following your argument, counsel, you seem to be saying that Adolf revoked the 1994 agreement in steps. First, he revoked the 1994 trust that was express, and then by adopting a new will, he revoked that provision in the 1994 agreement as well. Am I tracking your analysis? The reason I'm asking is these are not part of the stipulated facts that the district court had in front of it.
Yeah, I think you've characterized my argument fairly, Your Honor. Certainly, Adolph Wagner did not form a new will until after Janet's death, approximately 2 months or so after her death. And so his will, at least to my knowledge, was not revoked prior to that time. The only revocation that we're aware of is the document executed by Adolph revoking the trust, which occurred some 10 days before Janet's death.
So, counsel, I'd like you to turn your attention to what fiduciary duties, if any, Adolph had at the time that he first had this power to unilaterally revoke the 1994 trust and did it, and then waited until after Janet's death before he transferred the assets from the 1994 trust into his own name.
So two parts to that question. First of all, did he have a fiduciary duty to Janet to advise her in some way other than simply the revocation that he did? The probate code specifically indicates that a trust can be revoked by a conspicuous indication. There was no argument by the appellants at the district court level that the act of revocation by Adolph was ineffective, that it was flawed in some way. But there is a stipulation that Janet did not know about it. I would suggest that stipulation was actually potentially for the second portion of our agreement for trial, which would have been a damaged section of trial, in which, you know, our arguments about equity and so forth could have been suggested. With regard to the funding, the defunding of the old trust and the funding of the new trust, again, I think the Hall case is clear that trustee has a reasonable time frame in which to wind up the actions of a trust and start the process of a new trust. That issue was, in fact, submitted to the trial court, and the court found that the two-month time frame that it took Adolph to do that was a reasonable time frame to accomplish those tasks, especially since Janet's death intervened in that time frame.
So, counsel, that would assume that what Adolph was doing was a wind-up of the trust. And that's what I'm questioning. Is there, you know, explain to me your analysis on that, because I think the argument would be, you know, Janet has died. Theoretically, her will is going to be probated at that point, or at least is going to be administered. So he is essentially moving assets that would have been impacted, isn't he?
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Okay, tell me why not.
First of all, the trust no longer exists at the time that Janet passes away because it's been revoked by Adolph, and he has the authority to revoke the trust. So arguably, no trust exists at that moment in time when Janet passes away because the trust has been effectively revoked by Adolph's act. Secondly, the argument here is not what assets should have been in Janet's probate estate and what could she have distributed in her will. That's not the argument here. The argument is that the assets in Adolph's current trust or his probate estate should be administered pursuant to the 1994 documents. This isn't an argument against Adolph's trust saying Janet has some assets in Adolph's trust, give them back to her. That would be a different lawsuit than the lawsuit that we have. And so at the time of Janet's death, if Janet had assets that Adolph transferred, that's an action that her estate needed to bring. That is not the present action that was before the trial court, however.
Well, I guess what it all boils down to, counsel, is I'm trying to understand your response to the argument of appellant that what Adolph did was effectively renounce Janet's will by first revoking the 1994 trust and secondly, then removing all of the assets. And again, of course, this assumes their theory that the Janet's will somehow revives or incorporates by reference in an independent way the 1994 trust. But just make that assumption for a moment and then tell me why it is that Adolph's actions didn't affect to a renouncement of her will.
And so it's hard for me to understand that argument. Essentially, what it is saying is if any assets remained at the time of Janet's death, even if they would have been in a revoked trust, that somehow that trust reoccurs. And I don't know what of those assets then should be in the purported trust of Janet's or in her probate estate. But my point simply is to say that's an argument for Janet's probate estate. It's not an argument that Adolph Wagner's 1994 will should be submitted to probate. It's a different argument, and it's not the argument was submitted for decision.
I think what they're arguing, counsel, is that it's a breach of the 1994 agreement. So that if that agreement has, and maybe that's just asking you to assume too much. You've already said that you don't think that agreement is valid anymore. But again, assuming it is valid, it is a promise from Adolph not to renounce her will. Did he effectively do that?
I guess, Your Honor, if Adolph Wagner's agreement with his spouse survives unchanged, then yeah, the appellants prevail. It's our point that as soon as Adolph revoked the trust, he continued to have authority to revoke other documents associated with the 1994 plan. So you're right, it is hard for me to assume those facts to give you an answer. And I'm short, just about out of time, so unless there's any other questions, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Very much appreciate your argument. And counsel for appellant, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I note that counsel's point is well taken that, there are certain things that are not part of this lawsuit. We would have loved to have brought that lawsuit. We didn't know about any of this until decedent passed away. Had we known what decedent had done, maybe we would have brought a lawsuit as part of Janet Wagner's estate. As it were, he did not tell her or her children. So we are in the position of not having been able to bring that lawsuit because of decedent's actions. We certainly did argue below that there was a breach of fiduciary duties here. There was a whole section of one of our briefs below on it. I know I wrote that brief. Margulis is a case quoted in our appellate brief. I'll just quote a brief section from that. Quote, most importantly, trustees owe a duty of loyalty to trust beneficiaries. Moreover, trustees owe beneficiaries a duty of full disclosure. Now, it is not full disclosure to revoke this trust 10 days before your spouse's death while she is lying on her deathbed and to not tell her or her children or anybody. I also want to note that section 524.2-514, this language about not to revoke having to be included, that is only talking about where all we have as written evidence of the agreement to devise is two wills and nothing else. This case that the respondents talk about, Olason v. Manti, that case is about an instance where all there was two wills in writing, no reference to any agreement in any of the wills. And one of the parties said, well, we had an oral contract to will or to devise. Now, there can be oral contracts to will or to devise, but only if there's evidence of that in writing. And that means that if all you have is wills and no other written evidence has to say, not these aren't going to be revoked, something like that to satisfy the statute. That's not what we have here. That's not an issue in this case because we have a full executed valid agreement signed by both parties that everyone, including the district court, seems to agree is a valid agreement. The trial court found by clear and convincing evidence that this was a valid agreement. Counsel just said that his client seemed to agree. Yes, the 1994 agreement was valid. So we know that there was an agreement. Now the question is, what does this agreement mean? And if it's unilaterally revocable, if either party can say, I no longer want to adhere to the agreement I made for any or no reason, just because I don't want my wife's children to inherit anything from our combined estate, what is the meaning of this agreement? I would posit that there is none. This is kind of a law school example of an agreement to agree until we no longer agree, which, as we maybe all remember, it's been a while for me. It is an illusory contract. Now, that's not what any of us found. We all agree that this is an enforceable contract. All the parties agree that at least at one time it was an enforceable contract. The district court found that it was by clear and convincing evidence, so it must have some meaning. There is no case that creates this two-part test that respondents are talking about, where you first have to prove the existence of a contract, then you have to prove that it's not unilaterally revocable. That's adding an element to contract formation. That is not what the Olayson case says or any other case. What those cases say is if all you have are the wills alone, yes, they have to include some reference to the wills being irrevocable. But there's all sorts of other cases that say you can have an agreement to devise your property in a certain way, even if you don't have wills at all at that time. You know, you just have to put those wills in place at some point. So the agreement is valid, and I think it means something. Now, we've been talking about the exact trust language and the exact language of wills and the agreement and the statutes, and that is all very important. But I want to leave you just asking yourselves this question. Beyond the strict construction of the language we're looking at here, is what Adolf Wagner did moral? Is it right? Is it the right thing to do? He promised his wife, and she promised him in 1994 that we're going to have an estate plan that provides for all of our children. They both brought children into the marriage, and that's what they agreed to. 10 days before she dies, without telling her, the parties agree. He didn't tell her. He tries to get out of that agreement. Now, I don't think that is the right thing to do, and I don't think that the law in Minnesota is set up to protect that as the right thing to do. With that, it looks like I'm running out of time. So unless there's any final questions, I will end it there. Thank you very much.
All right, it doesn't look like there are any questions. So counsel for appellant and for respondent, we thank you very much for your arguments today. It's a very interesting case and we appreciate your appearing today by WebEx. So with that, your case is submitted to the court for its decision and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe. So our court has completed the three oral arguments that are assigned to us on our calendar today. So we will be in recess for a